Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Stone. How are you doing this fine wintry morning?
Well, I'm doing well, and it is a little bit chillier outside than I thought it was going to be. I've got a busy week. I'm headed down to Pensacola on Thursday, and there's a ton of stuff I got to do between now and then.
Any Christmas shopping? Are you done with that?
Now, shopping's over with, but I got to get the car ready because we're headed to Pensacola, then over to Tallahassee, all the way down to Key West. So my errand list is rather long, but I imagine most people's is at this time of year.
Do you have anything you're going to listen to in the car? Or you make them listen to our shows?
I'm only going to listen to Dr. Fitness and the Fat Guy, High Velocity Radio, and maybe Executive Talk Radio, too. I might start listening to that. That's a new one. You know, I don't know if our listeners are aware of this or not, but by the time we get back from the holidays, aren't we launching like a half a dozen new shows?
Yeah, we have a busy first quarter.
Yeah, things are moving right along, and we've got an exciting show this morning. A little bit later in the program, we're going to hear from two guests that have joined us before, Daniel Bowers and Danny Kofke. But first up on the High Velocity Radio Show, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce a gentleman named Mike Ween with Ween & Associates. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Your reputation precedes you. Anyone here in town whom I've ever had a conversation with that I hold in any regard at all with respect to their opinion about and their experience with effectively marketing products and services, somehow, some way, Michael Ween comes up in that conversation. And if nothing else, you're definitely good with taglines. Right here on your business card says, "Fresh Perspectives for Profitable Growth." How about sharing us with us, if you would, a little bit of a feel for what you're out there doing for folks?
Well, thank you. We're having a good time. That's what we're doing. What we focus on is we help people primarily in professional services help position themselves, help figure out what their specific edge is, what their point of differentiation is. And in this highly competitive market with, you know, such a turbulent time and so many relationships right now, you know, really being reviewed, differentiating yourself from your competitors has become critical.
That's an interesting phrase, relationships being reviewed. Speak to that a little bit. What are you talking about there?
Well, one of the things that we're finding is that in the downturn in the economy, we saw a number of people being laid off. So we had staff reduction. We had marketing being cut back. We also had services that were being provided cut back. Morale in a lot of the service organizations has become an all-time low. And, you know, this results in clients' dissatisfaction. You know, they used to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, a lot of people are saying it's broke. And so a lot of client relationships, long-term client relationships, are in jeopardy. You know, a lot of marketing people will tell you that this is a really important time to build relationships with your existing customers. The counterintuitive thing, and what we talk to our clients about, is that there's never been a better time to build market share or gain new client relationships than today, because your competitors' client relationships are vulnerable.
So what kind of mistakes do people make as they're trying to differentiate themselves and carve out their own little corner in the sandbox? I suspect you probably see some of the same mistakes over and over, don't you?
You bet, Stone. I think the biggest mistake people make, particularly in what I'd like to maybe call desperate times, is they try to spread their net too wide. What they do is they go after any opportunity. You know, in fact, you know, I'll talk to someone in real estate, which is probably the area that's most hardest hit. And they'll say, you know, in times like this, we're going after everything. And that is a strategy that's, you know, destined to fail. It's just the opposite. The more specific you are, the better chance you are to differentiate yourself, the better chance you are to be viewed as a specialist and to really be able to address their needs, the better chance you have, frankly, to land the piece of business.
Now, can you walk us through what it's like if somebody kind of works with you? What's an engagement with you? Like, how does it start?
Well, Lee, there's a number of different types of ways we work with people. One, probably the fastest growing piece of business right now is just workshops, where we'll go into an organization and work with the individuals or work with the senior marketing team on helping them figure out how the organization is different and how they differentiate themselves, or how the individual partners, for instance, in a law firm that are responsible for building the business, how they have a unique perspective. So workshops is probably the leading area. A second way is lunch and learns that we provide. And, you know, it really helps people become much more effective in their networking by developing a better message, by developing better techniques in generating leads. And then the third area would be in leading, one-on-one coaching. And the one-on-one coaching is actually when you work with an individual and develop a marketing plan.
Now, what is the pain that they're having? Are they even noticing the pain?
Well, there's probably a couple of areas of pain that they're noticing. One is that they, you know, are not, when they go after proposals, they go after an RFP or a proposal for a new piece of business, their win rate isn't high enough. You know, they're only getting 25% of what they go after instead of getting 75% of what they're going after. And that would be a telltale sign that whatever they're saying is not differentiating themselves from everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, and maybe the more important, is that in professional services, so much of the business comes from either existing clients or referrals from strategic partners. And if they're not generating a lot of referrals, that's probably another sign that people out there really don't understand specifically what they do. And not just what they do, but what they do so well that they do it better than anyone else.
Now, is there, when you're working with professional services, especially professional services nowadays, there was a time when these lawyers and these CPAs, that they were just charged with doing really good work. And now it seems more and more of them are charged with doing really good work and also bringing in a bunch of business.
Yeah.
How is that shift? How are they doing with that?
Well, you know, in part of my career, I spent 8 years with Deloitte working with some of the senior partners there. And, you know, they used to tell me that when they joined the firm, it was actually illegal to aggressively market. The world has changed dramatically. And, you know, all organizations, whether it's Deloitte or whether it's a two-person CPA firm, you have to be much more proactive now at going after the business. You can't just sit by and let the phone ring.
And is the phone ringing for these professional service firms?
If they're working with Mike, it is.
He makes the phone ring.
You know, it probably is, but it is because someone has recommended them and they're following up on a lead. They're following up on a referral. And that's what we try to do, help people, yes, get the phone to ring. But it's not the phone isn't ringing because of great social media. It's not ringing because
it's
you've got...
It's not their Twitter feed?
It's probably not their Twitter feed. It may be that will continue a relationship or deepen a relationship. And I don't want to underestimate the importance of that, particularly thought leadership. But to start a new relationship, people aren't reading ads and making telephone calls. They're listening to trusted advisors. They're listening to their friends who have had a positive experience. And they're saying, you ought to call this firm.
So how do you go about properly pricing professional services? Say that fast 5 times. But pricing professional services, that seems like it could be a real struggle in, A, setting the appropriate price, and then being able to... communicate it or defend it. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I think that in most business situations right now, there is such a focus on return on investment, ROI. And then nothing could be further from the truth, whether it's an accounting firm or, frankly, a marketing organization. You know, people want to see that anything that I provide is going to help their revenues grow. If it's an accounting firm, anything that they provide is going to probably, you know, make them be more efficient or help them, you know, close the books faster or, frankly, reduce their taxes. In a law firm, it's to minimize their legal expenses and even anticipate some of the potential pitfalls that they might fall into and avoid costly lawsuits or costly litigation. So they're looking for ways to operate the company more profitably. And that's two ways, increasing revenues and reducing expenses.
So how do you go about, or how would you advise somebody like Lee that just doesn't know much about it, how to go out and shop for professional marketing support? Like, what kind of questions should I be asking you in an interview if I'm entertaining the idea of engaging you or someone like you to help us?
Well, the fact of the matter is that there are two things that are so important in hiring someone from professional services. One is their reputation, and the second is relationship. And those things are so hard to actually quantify. You know, the individual trying to build a reputation or a relationship, it has to be done not by providing claims like we answer the phone faster or we'll return the calls in 24 hours, but it's really by providing facts. And it's we specialize in working with, you know, high-tech businesses who are looking to refinance the business. So it's providing facts or, you know, the fact that, you know, where your schooling is, where your education is, or testimonials from other clients. So, you know, the point of to really differentiate yourself, it is challenging, but you've got to come up with some points of differentiation that are not claims, they're facts.
So this is going to be a lot like that cobbler's kids have no shoes question probably, but I'm fascinated by your profession, but I'm very curious to know, how do you go to market? How do you, because you've got to be able to do all these things you're telling these people to do, right?
Stone, you couldn't be further from the truth as far as the cobbler's kids have no shoes. as a matter of fact, just 2 months ago, I finally broke down and realized that I'm doing such a great job with my clients, but in all fairness, I could not do it myself. And I actually went out and hired a marketing consultant out of Washington to help me do what I'm doing to my clients. And she was just brilliant. In fact, even suggested that I change the name. And in January, we'll be changing the name to the Specific Edge Institute and really help people find what their specific edge is, what they're famous for, what differentiates them. So it's a funny question. But how do I do it? The most effective way I've found is I go out to lunch with someone. And during that one-hour lunch, I believe I can ask them enough questions to find out what they're famous for, what their specific edge is, and then talk a little bit about the three key things in marketing, which is who's your target, what's your message, and what vehicles are you going to use to send that message to the target. And in that hour, usually there's no RFP. They realize that I've created enough doubt that they might not know what they're doing exactly and welcome the opportunity for an ongoing engagement.
Well, there's two phrases that really struck me as you were describing that. One was you said help them discover what they're famous for, what they want to be famous for. That strikes me as a very productive and interesting exercise that people just think through, what do we want to be famous for? Is that something you do with a lot of your clients?
That's what I do with all of my clients. Stone, can I give you an example?
Sure, please.
I was working with a lawyer, and a very successful lawyer at one of the Atlanta law firms, and I asked him, you know, what does he do? And, you know, in a cocktail party, he would say that he's a, you know, a lawyer, and he does commercial transactions. So, you know, I ask you and all of the listeners, how many lawyers do you know that do commercial transactions? It's not a point of differentiation. He was spreading his net as wide as possible. I talked to him and over one of these lunches and discovered that some really interesting things about him. He is a pilot. He spent most of his young years working at an airport. About 20% of his business is actually helping people buy and sell jets. And now if you asked him what he does, you know, his specific edge is that he helps people buy and sell airplanes. Now, a lot of people would say that's pretty limiting, but when you get the majority of the share of the business in Atlanta now of people buying and selling airplanes, it's you know it can be quite a lucrative business. And what I loved, I just got his holiday card, and guess what's on the front of the holiday card?
An legal airplane transaction,
a commercial transaction, right?
That's right, an airplane, and a little Christmas tree on the side. And his specific edge is three things: one, he's a lawyer. Two, he's a pilot and understands and can speak the language. And three, he understands the FAA and the rigorous rules in certifying an airplane. He's the guy, when the Specific Edge Institute buys an airplane, I can assure you we will use him to handle the transaction.
Well, that's a heck of an endorsement. And I'll bet you've already taught him to do the other phrase that stuck out for me. I bet you've taught him to create some doubt in those conversations, haven't you?
He creates some doubt, some wonderful doubt. He tells a story about how if you own an airplane and you take someone you're doing business with on that plane, and that person, because they can't accept the free flight, pays you the coach amount fare for that flight, which I think is normal, you have just violated your certification. Your insurance is not in force, and it happens because the person has paid you for that flight, and you all of a sudden become a commercial charter as opposed to just a private aircraft. And that's the story he'll tell, and he will scare the heck out of anybody.
Good stuff.
Well, I think we have an idea for a new show, Lunch with Mike. So we have Lunch with Mike here. Mike talks to him. He creates a little doubt. He gives him a little bit. So what do you think? I'll tell you what would be fun, though, all kidding aside, and if you'd be up for this, I think it'd be fun to have you come back in the studio sometime with a delighted client, maybe the guy you're talking about, and kind of get this specific edge story from, you know, from a client.
Stone, we'd love to come back. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, listen, before we let you go, let's make sure that our listeners know how to reach out to you and get some valuable information with regard to how they can create that specific edge.
Well, I appreciate that. The easiest way is to give me a call, 770-518-0711. That's 770-518-0711. I also welcome email. It is mike.ween, and ween is spelled W-I-E-N, at ween, also W-I-E-N, dash associates.com. That's mike.ween at ween dash associates.com.
Well, thank you again for joining us, and we will look forward to having you back in the studio, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Hey, listen, can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
You bet. I want to hear what they have to say.
All right. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show with the French-American Chamber of Commerce is our buddy Daniel Bowers. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Don. Good to see you and Lee again.
Good to see you, too. And we learned before we went on air something I did not know, but you actually are a formally trained pastry chef. Is this true?
That's right. I'm a former pastry chef and a formally trained pastry chef as well, so... Yes, part of my background in working with France is actually having lived abroad. I spent a year in Paris and trained at the Cordon Bleu, and worked in a little bakery in a pastry shop right about a 10-minute walk from the Eiffel Tower.
So what was your signature dish?
Yeah. So when I think about what Mike was saying, the thing that I want to be known for, I think my specific edge is a pastry called the Palmier, which is folds of puff pastry that's layered with sugar. And when you bake it, the sugar kind of caramelizes. And it comes out kind of in the shape of a heart or a palm frond, and that's why it's called a palmier. But I could always judge a really good French pastry chef by the quality of their palmier. So.
Well, their loss is our gain. What's the French Chamber of Commerce up to these days?
Well, we're active. We're out spreading the word of France and how important the global community especially is to the Southeast. And so it's kind of a message that I think gets lost a little bit when we talk about economic turmoil and we talk about domestic problems. But we're here primarily just to show that the French are here. They're investing in the Southeast, and we're excited about that, and we're glad to have them here, and we're glad to have the global community here in Atlanta and in the Southeast.
Can you speak a little bit about what you do on a day-to-day basis? Are you helping French companies come here to Georgia and America, or are you helping companies go to France?
We are happy to do both, Lee. That's our primary mission is to do exactly both of those things, and mm-hmm. that's to serve as a resource for French companies wanting to invest in the Southeast and as a resource for U.S.-based companies who want to seek a market in Europe and use France as maybe a launching point for their products or strategies. So when Mike was speaking earlier, it's very interesting because a lot of what he's talking about doing is kind of what we do too, and that's relationship building. So we don't really have products to sell to people. We're a professional services company as well, albeit a nonprofit, but we're here really to provide that service of relationship building and of reaching your target market. And so what Mike does speaks really highly to what we do as well in a very specific manner. So.
Well, we're going to have you clock in and tell us very specifically, why would a French organization want to come out here and hang out with us rednecks here in Marietta? What's in it for them?
And actually, what's interesting is when you look at the layout, there's almost 200 French companies right now in Georgia alone.
Wow.
So it's really a big market when you think of it in terms of numbers. And why do they come here? Well, they come to Georgia primarily for a number of reasons. We look at Georgia strategically from a logistics distribution hub. We've got a great airport. We have favorable tax incentives through the state of Georgia. We have great support from government agencies and really top quality investment climate here in Georgia. But why would they come up here to Sandy Springs? It's funny because when you look at the layout of French companies in the metro area, which we just did, we kind of plotted them on a Google map to see where they were. A lot of them were in Sandy Springs and up in the Gwinnett County area. So it was pretty interesting to see where they kind of drop.
And why is that,
geographically?
I have an idea. It's because the Lee Cantors and the other folks with deep pockets.
I think so. They wanted to be near you guys, coin, for right? one thing. I mean, if you're going to be anywhere, it's
you
like...
Know, that does make sense now that you say that.
So, yeah.
So, any pastry chefs we should know about here?
Any local pastry chefs? Well, I live right around the corner from Alon's Bakery, we're a little bit spoiled. So, yeah.
Well, how about the other way? Why would an organization like Business Radio X, why should maybe we be looking at having studios in France, or should we?
I think it's a great idea. For one, the European market is, of course, the largest economy in the world. So, compared to the U.S., the number of people and the amount of dollars that get spent or euros that get spent, and you know, there's a lot of fear right now with what's going on in Europe. But we're kind of here to reassure people and hopefully let them know that a lot of the decisions that are being made by the governments in Europe are hopefully gonna pan out in the end and when they invest in themselves. But for one, it's an enormous market, Stones, just to give you an idea. And France is actually very favorable today in terms of an investment climate as well. The new leadership in France under Sarkozy, for good or bad, has made it very easy for small companies to open up in France. I think they say there were 10,000 small businesses that were opened in France over the last year, an enormous number of small businesses. And maybe that's really understating what the real number is. But the number of small businesses that have opened there in the last year has been phenomenal, and the investment climate has become much more favorable for outside investment into France.
Now, say we wanted to open in France, we would go to you and you would help us get the lay of the land over there, maybe put us in contact with some resources?
That's absolutely right. We have relationships, and when we talk about relationship building, part of what I have done over the last year since I've taken over the French is to really get to know these organizations that can help these help companies, American right. companies, go find the right place to invest. So we have specific relationships with companies that are headquartered here in the U.S. or that work here in the U.S. For example, there's one called ERAI, which is the Entreprise Rhône-Alpes Internationale, which is specifically tailored to bringing investment into the Rhône-Alpes region of France and can help you explore the reasons you'd want to go invest in that region. There's another organization up in New York called Invest in France Agency that really works as a trade commission trying to bring investment from the U.S. into France. And they know all the departments, all the cities, all the strategic areas where you would want to go, where you could find favorable tax incentives and a favorable climate for your type of business.
Did you hear him slide right into French accent?
He breaks that out occasionally.
Well, the same thing happens to me when I go to Pensacola. I come back sounding a little more like Andy Griffith than I already do.
Yeah.
That happens to you, too.
When in Rome, Stone. When in Rome, that's right. Or when in Pensacola. So
it's been my impression, because I've hung out with you guys a little bit in the international community, that you are an incredibly collaborative group. Speak to that a little bit, if you will, and some of the other international the consulates and the other multinational chambers of commerce.
You're absolutely right. I think we're very fortunate here in Atlanta to have such an international climate and community, which represents 70 to 80 part-time and full-time consul generals
wow.
who are headquartered here in Atlanta. So a lot of people don't even realize that almost 80 countries are represented here in Atlanta with a formal dignitary who represents that country and is here to serve the people of that country. And we also have about 40 bilateral chambers of commerce, what we call a bilateral, which is French-American, British-American, Chinese-American. There are about 40 here in Atlanta. Now, granted, many of them are smaller and don't have full-time employees, but they're still very present, and they're here to serve the business community for those countries and for those nationals who live here. And when we speak of collaboration, you're exactly right. And we have really taken kind of the forefront, I would like to say, between myself and a few others in the international community to try and bring these organizations a little bit closer together, to work together a little bit more and more. And unfortunately, Ray Gilbert couldn't be here this morning, but he's the former head of the British American Business Group.
Yeah, he's a neat guy.
And he's a really neat guy, too. And we've with some other folks from downtown, Sanjay Patel and some other folks who are very global-minded, we've kind of taken it upon ourselves to try and really promote the globalness of Atlanta. And you'll see this with somebody like Phil Bolton, who's got Global Atlanta, a world news source here in Atlanta, that there's a drive to expose the community of the metro Atlanta and of Georgia to what the international investment means to this area.
Now, you did an event at the end of last year, and you have an upcoming event?
We did, and it was actually in July of last year, and you guys were with us. I know, it's hard to remember so far back.
Was it really that long?
Yeah, too much
eggnog
this morning.
We did the remote broadcast. We were on the floor. We did like a little radio show right there on site.
Yeah, it was July 26th. We had the first Global Connect event that we did at the 200 Peachtree Center, which is where your new station is,
right?
Which is really neat, a beautiful center down there. And we had Global Connect, and we brought almost 1,000 people, globally minded people together in the 200 Peachtree Center. And we had about 35 chambers of commerce, international chambers, and about 20 businesses who came down and displayed, and 20 restaurants who came down and served food to all of the attendees.
And you're doing that again?
And we're going to be doing that again very soon. So we'll be looking for us towards the end of February. We're planning the next Global Connect event. And you can find out more about that at globalconnectevents.com. The website will be coming up soon, but that's
Are you involved in organizing that?
I am to some extent. From the French perspective, we're going to help participate.
So you're going to class it up.
We're going to try. Well, there'll be French wine this time, so yes, and some French cheese.
So a big part of your ongoing mission, and I suppose this is true for all of those bilateral chambers of commerce and the consulates that you mentioned, it's not only executing the work that you described, which is incredibly valuable, or at least I think we would find it valuable if we were looking at going to France, but it's not only executing the work, it's also just getting the awareness, the word out there that these resources are available, because I don't think the average Joe Sixpack out here knows that, do they?
Right, and that's probably one of your challenges, to get a person to think globally, because a lot of business could translate there if they were just given the opportunity.
Right, it's not always obvious, and it's a difficult leap to make, because it can be scary from a language perspective and a culture perspective. And you're right, though. This is one of the things that we're here to do is kind of what Mike said, is build those relationships and let people know that these opportunities exist.
Well, we'll keep our ear to the ground, and we'll try to introduce you to someone that knows something about marketing. If we come across anybody.
That would be great. Yeah, we could always use that help. So.
Thank you, Stone.
No, but you're absolutely right that I think most of the, or a lot of the community, when you talk to people and I tell them who I work for, they're like, really? Well, I didn't know that existed.
Right.
What is that? And so one of my major goals is has been to get out more and to present to people what the bilateral chambers are, and especially what the French chamber is. I mean, we represent about 15,000, there are about 15,000 French nationals who live in the southeastern part of the United States.
That's the one French word I know, we.
We, that's right, exactly. That was the proverbial W-E, not the O-U-I, but you're right. So it is a big community, but again, it probably pales in significance to some of the other international communities that we see much more readily around the community. And the German community is very active in investment. We see a great number of companies from Germany who come to the Southeast and work here, and it's really it's a great source of investment and a great source of jobs creation for our area.
Now, having a robust international community, is this kind of unique to Atlanta, or is this happening in cities all over the country?
Well, it's I would say it's more of a regional phenomenon, where we find certain cities that have taken on kind of a regional leadership in that area. But it is regional from that perspective, where, you know, we look at the Southeast. When we talk about our territory, we talk about the Southeast as a whole. I don't talk about just Georgia,
Atlanta,
or just Atlanta. I mean, we go over to Alabama and up to Tennessee and to South Carolina, and our economies are so intertwined that it's really tough to speak about just the metro Atlanta area. Because let's face it, the Kia plant that came into LaGrange, it didn't benefit just Georgia.
Sure.
Mississippi picked up a ton of jobs and a ton of new tax revenue in Alabama. And from the companies that came to support those plants, who invested not just in Georgia, but also in Alabama and around the metro Atlanta area. So we're much more today a regional economy, I think, than just a local economy. But it's true that Atlanta, greatly benefits from having that airport down the street from us and
from a lot of other things.
And that new international terminal that's going to be opening this summer is going to make a great, great change, I think, to the city.
Now, what about the port in Savannah?
Well, and of course, that's going to be the next big driving force of growth throughout the whole region. So you see some changes that are being made at the governmental level, at the state level, that are preparing us for that long-term shift to having a lot more transport come through Atlanta and through Georgia from the opening and the widening of that port in Savannah, the deepening.
But then when the international community sees those kind of moves, does that make them just want to invest more in this area?
I would have to say absolutely. I mean, when you see that the port is going to be deepened and that we're preparing our roads and the infrastructure for that traffic, it's much more attractive as a place of entry, I think, for a foreign investor.
So when a foreign investor is deciding how to allocate resources and funds, and they see that kind of gets them excited about this region rather than maybe spend it somewhere else.
Well, it has to. It has to. And that's part of the long-term competitiveness of the state of Georgia, I think. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the folks, the good folks who work at the Georgia Department of Economic Development and what they do on a daily basis, which is to go find those companies and bring them here to Georgia, that's what they're selling, is that we're prepared for the long term. And this is going to be a hub of growth for the entire United States.
Right.
So yeah, that Port of Savannah is going to be a great boon to the state of Georgia from an economic standpoint.
Right.
So.
Well, you certainly owe it to yourself to continue to keep up your pastry skills. But I, for one, am glad that we've got you here in Georgia.
Well, thank you.
And it's been an absolute delight having you on the show again. And I don't think one show can contain this guy. Two shows can't contain. There's too much going on over there. We gotta check in with you from time to time and have you back, man.
Well, last time Ray was here, so I couldn't get a word in
edgewise. You didn't get to talk last time,
I didn't even
right?
get to say my name.
You were supposed to pick him up and bring him here, Ray, and you forgot. Is that what happened?
I wanted to have my turn to shine. Exactly. My 20 minutes. Of fame. So
Ray's standing on the corner right now,
like,
probably
shaking his fist at me.
Where's Daniel? He said 9:30.
So how can our listeners reach you?
Well, let me just give the one last bit of information. Yeah. And that's, they can reach me at the facc-atlanta.com, and that's the French American Chamber of Commerce of Atlanta, facc-atlanta.com. And you can find out more about Global Connect, which this year is going to be really amazing. And we're looking to more than 1,300 visitors to this event with some new ways for generating leads. When Mike was talking about leads generation, relationship building, and how important that is, that's our number one goal, is to make it valuable for businesses and for people to come down there to meet people and meet that next client. So find us down at the 200 Peachtree Center sometimes toward the end of February at globalconnectevents.com. And we hope to see you down there.
Well, I'll tell you what, Lee, we should try to coordinate some interviews leading up to that event in the new studio at 200 Peachtree.
Yeah.
Just get some advanced promotion for us. So, let's make that happen.
Is that where the event's going to be?
It will be. It will be down
in the Grand Atrium,
at the Grand Atrium.
So we're right there on that mezzanine level. Right. We ought to, let's maybe put some thought into that after the show or something. We ought to talk that through.
Happy to.
Well, thanks for coming back, man.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Hey, don't go anywhere. Hang with us. We got one more guy to visit with. And this gentleman has been with us before as well, teacher and author, Danny Kofke. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Stone. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Yeah, we are delighted to have you. So you were able to break off for a little bit. Is school over for now? You got like a couple weeks off for Christmas?
Yes, Christmas break, so.
Well, man, my heart goes out to my folks were both teachers. Mm-hmm. And so I know how much work can mm-hmm. be involved. And what an incredibly noble profession. My hat is off to you. But beyond providing support for folks in that arena, you have also authored a couple of books. Tell us a little bit about both, and particularly this last one you put out.
All right. Well, my first book is titled How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary, and that came out towards the end of 2007. And that was kind of my wife and my story on how we got to the point that she was able to become a stay-at-home mom and we lived on my teacher's salary. She was a first grade teacher for 12 years before becoming a stay-at-home mom. And actually, for your listeners that all know, when you write a book, sometimes between the time you write it and you find a publisher and the book actually comes out, there's some time in between those. So I wrote that book. I actually started it towards the end of 2005. And at that point, Tracy, my wife, had been a stay-at-home mom just for 1 year. We had one daughter. Well, here we are now. Last Christmas break, actually, I started my new book, A Simple Book of Financial Wisdom, Teach Yourself and Your Kids How to Live Wealthy with Little Money. And I just felt like in those 5 years between the time I wrote my first one and then, that I had learned so much more about how to handle money. We added another daughter to the mix. Tracy was able to continue to stay at home, so had two girls, and she stayed at home for 7 years. And doing it all on about $40,000 a year. And despite that, we have no debt except our mortgage. We invest each month for our retirement. We have a one-year emergency fund in place. But to me, the most important thing, and this is where I want to give hope to others, especially in these most difficult times, is we're able to make it, and we're able to do it. And I'm just a school teacher. I'm not an economics major. But the personal finance, the everyday issues, to me, are not that difficult. So many people make them out to be these huge things that we can't do. Now, obviously, when it comes to investing in stocks, mutual funds, and different types of insurance, you'd want to seek a professional. But the day-to-day budgeting, it isn't that difficult. And I know the media plays a big role. We watch it, and we see all these sob stories. And times are tough for a lot of people, but I feel that when you watch that, a lot of people will throw in the towel, wave the red flag, and give up, say, you know what, if this person can't do it, then I'm never going to be able to handle money either. And I kind of want to show the opposite of that, that yes, you can. It may take some sacrifice and some discipline, but you can do it. It's not as hard as so many people make it out to be.
Now, you chose to have two kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of increased the difficulty level a little bit.
Right.
Do you want to go and add like three or four more to see, you know, what kind of the max is?
Man, with my luck, I'd have three or four more daughters, and that would be, what, six weddings to pay for? So no, we're good with two. We've debated about having another one, but they're both at the independent stage now. So it's kind of nice to be have nights where you don't have to wake up in the middle of the night anymore. I kind of like my sleep.
Now, your story has resonated not just amongst us here in the studio, but you've gotten a lot of national acclaim. Is that right?
Yes, I have. I've been fortunate enough that I've been on Fox and Friends, 700 Club, Clark Howard Show, CBS Early Show, and a few others. So
you finally hit the big time.
There
now
you
you're on High Velocity Radio.
Go.
You're at the pinnacle,
That's
baby.
Right. That's right. But I think what happened, I was fortunate, and it's interesting when you're talking about marketing earlier, I was fortunate at the time, you know, the economy started to take a nosedive in 2008, and that was when my first book, shortly after that, it came out, and people were starting to think a little differently. If my book had come out in the early 2000s when we were spending like there was no tomorrow and people really didn't care, they were buying $300,000 homes on a $50,000 a year salary, it probably wouldn't have resonated. But people were forced, and they have been right now, forced to change their ways. And the interesting thing is the advice I give, it's no different than advice that was around 100 years ago, 50 years ago. Basically, spend less than you earn. I mean, that's kind of it. But when you put that into play, it becomes a lot more difficult, as evident by the mess our country is in right now with a lot of people overspending. So I think that's where I was fortunate to get that media exposure, is that people were looking to make a change. And here it is. Here's a school teacher. Most people can relate to a school teacher. I'm not a CEO of a company and not this high businessman, but we can do it. And if we can do it, like I mentioned before, then others can do it too.
Now, is the gap largely psychological? Because it sounds like it's fairly trainable, the basics of managing your money effectively. Is it a psychological gap? And if so, how do you plug it?
I do believe that money problems are probably 80% emotional. I feel that way.
Wow.
Because the math, okay, let's just do an easy example. Let's just, you put a credit card, $100 on a credit card, we'll say 24% APR. You don't make a payment all year. How much are you going to owe after the end of the year? Well, 24% of $100 is $24, $124, eighth, ninth grade math. But yet so many people use credit cards and they know the pitfalls of them. And I think there's a lot of people, whether it's spiritually, emotionally, with their husbands, their jobs, whatever, they're unhappy and they buy stuff to fill that unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, if I go out and buy a brand new shirt, it feels great first five or six times you wear it. But after six or seven times, that feeling of newness goes away. And if you base your sense of happiness on a materialistic item, bam, you're in this vicious cycle. I actually kind of compare money issues to weight loss. Right now in our country, we have pretty much all of the nutritional information for any piece of food we put into our mouths, yet nearly two-thirds of our country is either overweight or obese. We know it's not healthy to go by our favorite restaurant and order a number two, supersize it, but a lot of people still do. The same reason is with credit cards. Most of us know, especially right now, Christmas time, the holiday season, we know we don't have the money to buy things, but yet a lot of people will put it on a credit card even though they don't have the money in the bank to cover it, because it gives them that momentary feeling of satisfaction or happiness. I mean, we live in one of the wealthiest countries on earth, yet thousands and thousands of people seek professional help every year because they're unhappy. So it does show, it shows that money doesn't buy happiness. Yes, it takes away a lot of worries, absolutely, but there are plenty of celebrity stories of very, very wealthy people out there that made a lot of money over their lives, but they end up filing for bankruptcy or are broke. So basically, if you spend more than you earn, doesn't matter if you make $10,000 a year or $100,000 a year or $1 million a year, you're going to be in trouble.
Now, if you were going to coach a child, how would you go about doing that and make them kind of financially savvy?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because we started stuff with our daughters. And when my oldest daughter, Ava, she's now 7, but when she turned 3, we had some basic chores. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not a big fan of rewarding people for things that they should be doing. But I made an exception here with her. And she had to do basic chores, clean your room, you know, those things that three-year-olds can easily accomplish. And we had a chore chart set up. And every week or every day that she would do it, we'd put a check. And at the end of the week, she'd get paid. And it was only a dollar. That's how much she could make. But we have 3 jars, one labeled giveaway, one labeled savings, and one labeled spending. So automatically, when she immediately got paid that dollar, 10% or a dime would go in the giveaway jar, 25% or a quarter would go in that savings jar, and the rest would go in the spending jar. And over time, as she grew 3-4 years old, she kind of got it. She knew where to put her money. And I just think that basic principle right there, if most adults did that, you gave away 10% first, save 25%, and you spent the rest, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in. So just that basic principle. But then as she got older, once she turned 6, I upped the ante a little bit. And I said, you know what, those chores that you're doing now, they're expected of you as a household member, but I'm going to give you a raise, but you're going to have to work a little bit harder. So I showed her every Sunday she has to go around the house and gather the garbage to take out. And also, Tracy, I showed her how to clean the bathroom. This her own bathroom, showed how to scrub the toilet, clean the bathroom mirror. And I'll say, if you do these chores every week, instead of a dollar, I'll give you a 50% raise. You get $1.50. And she really started to do that. And what my goal was at that point was to show her, you know what? Now you know how to manage money, the basic principles of managing money. Now, if you work harder and go above and beyond, because probably most 6-year-olds are not scrubbing their toilet. So if you do unlike others in life, you will be usually rewarded and earn more money. So just little things like that. Another thing is, too, we're very open with our children. I mean, I know it's going to be difficult 5 years from now, or 2 teenage daughters, but hopefully I'm laying the foundation to teach them, you know, that dad may say you can't have this because he's just so mean. I will say how much I bring in a month. We've chosen this life. We felt it was best for mommy to be a stay-at-home mom and me to be a teacher. So we don't make as much money as some of your friends, but look at these dads. They get home at 7:30 at night, and they don't see their kids. We've made that choice to be able to spend time with you. So this is how much money I make. I still have to pay the mortgage. I have to pay the heat, and I explain everything to her. So I'm not just saying no because I'm so mean. I'm saying no because I have other priorities to do first. And I also try to relate things in the cost of how much I have to work. I earn about $100 a day, I'll say. So for instance, this Christmas, she wanted an iPod Touch. I said, really, you're 7, an iPod Touch? I said, that costs about $250. I would have to go to work for almost 2.5 days, and the entire amount of money I earn would have to go towards that gift. So I try to put it in those words for her, too. That way, as she does get older, she can see, okay, if I work this amount of hours, then this is what I can buy. So just kind of just open and honest. I think so many parents, they make financial topics such a taboo issue. I've even talked to my pastor at church, and he'll say families come to him and they'll talk about drug abuse and affairs, but money still remains this issue that people are embarrassed to talk about. So I think it's just that open lines of communication and not being afraid to discuss it. And to me as a parent and as a teacher as well, I'll tell you right now, as a teacher, we do a horrible job of teaching financial literacy. So as a parent, it's your job. And many parents, they feel because they have made mistakes, we don't want to admit our mistakes, but what a great opportunity to teach your child to say, you know what, I really screwed this up, but I'm going to change. Right. And it shows a kid, it's okay to mess up, but the important thing is, and not just money issues, but other issues, the important thing is we learn from our mistakes to never let it happen again. So I think, like in most things, honesty is just the best policy.
I'll tell you what I liked about his illustration with the jars.
Yeah.
Spending was the last jar. I mean, was that intentional? Or is that
It is. It is. And The cool thing with those jars, especially now when she got older, my 4-year-old isn't so much. I mean, she does the jars and the basic chores. But Ava, the 7-year-old, now she sees more and more when we go to the store. She wants certain things. And I'll say, you got to go home and check the savings or spending jar. And if you have enough, you can come back and buy it. And it's her own money. So she spends it differently. There was a book fair last year at school. And if you're a parent out there with book fairs at schools, it's like Black Friday for kids. They go nuts. Well, there was a Taylor Swift book that she had to have. And I was a former first grade teacher. Tracy taught first grade for 10 years. So Ava probably has, I mean, no lie, there's probably 5,000 books she has. I said, really, you want this Taylor Swift book? She goes, I really want it, Dad. It would cost $5. I said, well, we'll check your jar. She had $5. Next day, she went to school with that $5. came home. She still had the $5 in her pocket. I said, well, what happened? She goes, well, they didn't have the book that I wanted, so I kept it. I said, are you serious? And she goes, yeah. I said, because most kids, most adults, if they had the money in their pocket, they would have spent it on something else.
Right.
The cool thing is the next day the media specialist called me, and they actually had misplaced that book, and they found it. So I went and got her out of class. I said, this is a great lesson, Ava. Now you have the money. They found the book, so you still have that money, and you can buy it. Most people would have bought something that they really didn't want with that money. And then when that thing they really wanted became available, they don't have the money to buy it. So then they put it on a credit, and then they're going to owe more over time. So Just I think those are the little things that come up in our daily lives that we're kind of open and honest with her about it, just so she can see it. And she gets it. I mean, if you ever sit down with a kid and play a video game, a five-year-old, they can figure it out in about half an hour better than I can. So I just think a lot of times we underestimate of how much kids can really get. So I think as a parent, almost any time you can teach them a lesson, go for it.
You also mentioned very briefly in that same illustration some percentages. Is there a formula or some guidelines on percentages for these different aspects of our life in your experience?
Well, I mean, just kind of go biblically with the tithe, so 10%. And I just thought 25% for savings is a good amount. I mean, that could be for an emergency fund, or that could be for retirement. I mean, usually you're not going to invest that much. Most of us don't have that much disposable income coming in to put that much away. But if you started at the beginning, then maybe over time you got used to that, then it would become easier. And that's why I try to start at a young age. And hopefully maybe they'll get used. Maybe probably not going to be able to put 25% away. But even if they did 15%, it's still better than most people are doing right now. And it will help them over time.
Well, I wish I was hosting this show when I was 9.
I was confused there for a minute because I thought when he meant giveaway, I was thinking taxes. So.
yeah.
And I thought 10% sounded really low.
No. That's actually the giveaway. It's just for people. We do it a lot this time of year. That over the year, people that are less fortunate than us, and even though we don't make a lot of money, I always try to say there are so many people out there that have a lot less than we do. And actually, it was just interesting. I mean, it's really, really a sad story, but at our school, we got an email Friday afternoon after we left that one of our families, working hard family, had 5 kids, but their house burnt to the ground, and they lost all their clothes and lost everything. So this year, and actually, they were going to the school today to kind of give some money to help them, but just kind of, I want to show them that we are very, very blessed, and that, you know, there's always people that have a lot more than we do, but there's also people that have a lot less than we do, too.
So how can our listeners get their hands on this book, man?
The best way, if you just want to go to my website or Google search me, it's probably the easiest. My website comes up first. So it's Danny Kofke. So DannyKof as in Frank, K-E. But my book's also available at BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, and some bookstores as well.
Well, you're doing a terrific job, man. Very important work. Thanks so much for joining us, and I definitely want to read this second book.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
Yes, sir. Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, our guests this morning, Mike Ween, Daniel Bowers, and Danny Kofke, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family, saying we'll see you in the Fast Lane.